Hi guys, why not head to my official online store now? Shop at asmr1.com to check out the official AB1 leisurewear line as well as some goalkeeping products. Use the code SOS for 10% discount of all products on our website. Also, make sure you follow our social media pages for regular updates and to keep up with the latest products. Thank you guys for your support as always. Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of The Season Sports with me, Asmir Begovic, and my amazing producer, Rachel Humphreys. How are you, Rachel?
I'm very good, Asmir. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. We're in 2018. Can you believe it? Wow.
I can't believe it.
Yeah, I know. Listen, time flies. Hope you had a nice New Year's. Were you busy?
No, I didn't. No,
pretty
I purposely did very little over Christmas
same
and New Year.
That's same as me.
Really, did very little. Yeah, bit of a break.
No, just full on games. Holiday period for us is so busy.
Yeah,
so.
You footballers definitely don't get Christmas.
Yeah,
off.
We get the shorts on that one, but we can't complain too much overall. So it was good. So yeah, we're in 2018. We have a very special episode actually for you guys today. We're gonna be talking with author James Montague about some of his football books. If you're a football fan, just a general sports fan, these are some amazing stories that he has for us. He's done books such as When Friday Comes, 31-0, The Billionaire's Club. So it's amazing stories and insights into football all around the world, which is incredible. He's got some amazing stories from small countries to bigger countries to just crazy environments that he's traveled to. So can't wait to hear from him. And yeah, we're very much looking forward to this episode. So now we're moving on to our chat with James Montague, one of my favorite authors out there. Has made some amazing books. When Friday Comes, 31-0, and The Billionaire's Club. James, welcome to the Season of Sports. How are you, buddy?
Thanks for having me on. Great to hear. It's last time I met you, well, the first time I met you, actually, was just before Bosnia qualified for the 2014 World Cup finals.
Well, absolutely. That's taken us back a while. We met in Žilina.
It was, just before the game.
Just before the game when you were obviously getting some material for your book, 31-0. Yeah, I remember you from then, and I remember reading that book after, and then that book got, you know, made me carry on reading a couple of other books. You've impressed me very much.
Well, thanks very much. It was great. I remember that game very well because Bosnia had this, I remember we talked about it, they'd come so close on a couple of occasions to qualifying for a major tournament for the first time, and there was the suspicion, especially amongst Bosnian journalist friends of mine, that this might be another choke. And they kept on tweeting me, saying, stop tweeting about Bosnia, because they thought that every time I'd go to cover an international team, they usually lost, because 31-0 is essentially about teams that don't qualify for the World Cup. But thankfully, I did come. I did interview you. It was a famous victory. And of course, it wasn't the moment Bosnia qualified, but that was the moment, I think, that the Bosnians believed that qualification would happen. And then I think it was the Lithuania game was the most important moment, and that was what took you over the edge. And of course then the first World Cup finals in Brazil.
Yeah, absolutely. So we met before eighth game in qualifying in Slovakia, in Žilina, and we had just been beaten by Slovakia a couple days earlier, and that was, you know, where everything was in balance for us, and we ended up winning that game in Žilina, coming back from 1-0 down to winning 2-1. And that was the game I think we qualified, because if we didn't get a result that game, I think our hopes would have been, you know, done, and it would have vanished, and we would have maybe ended up in the playoff, and God knows what would have happened there. So I think that was the sort of special moment that carried us through, and made it a magical ride, and obviously carried on to our last two qualifying games, and obviously let us qualify in Lithuania, which was amazing. But yeah, we had a great story to tell. I'm not surprised you were run into some negative Bosnian attitudes, but that's the way they are in the Balkans. I believe you live in Belgrade now, is that right?
I do. I mean, I travel around. I mean, I'm still writing. I'm working on my next book at the moment, and still doing stuff for the New York Times and the BBC. And the football culture here, not just in Serbia, but all around the Balkans, is, I mean, as you know, it's incredible. So there are so many great matches, so many good players to see, so many interesting political stories as well, because, you know, football, I think, is a fantastic mirror on society. So you can understand a lot of what's going on. I mean, even in Bosnia, I mean, I remember going not that long ago to Banja Luka, you know, and if you take a look at the Bosnian League, for instance, it's a reflection of some of the dysfunction that you find in the country in wider sense. And same with Serbia, same with Croatia. Same with Montenegro, Kosovo even. I mean, I've been reporting a lot from Kosovo, and, you know, this is a... in fact, Safet Susic is being lauded as perhaps a potential new national team coach for them, which would be interesting.
Yeah, that would be interesting. Always interesting time in the Balkan football, you know, area, and a lot of things can happen always there and very unpredictable. But now I want to get on to you. I want to get on to your books. I want to start with your most recent book, The Billionaires Club, The Unstoppable Rise of Football's Super Rich Owners. Tell us a little bit about this book.
Well, there was a few years ago, actually, when my first book came out, When Friday Comes, and it's a book about the Middle East, essentially, about football in the Middle East, but also about politics, society, life. And one of the things that happened when it came out, there was Manchester City got taken over by a man no one had heard of called Sheikh Mansour, member of the Al Nahyan royal family of Abu Dhabi. And I remember people groping around, like, who is this guy? Why has the richest man, one of the richest men, one of the richest royal families in the world, a family of trillionaires, why have they bought a football club? And, you know, I suddenly my phone started going off because they were putting into Google or Yahoo, I mean, this was 10 years ago, Middle East journalists, football journalists, to try and find an expert Middle Eastern football, because there wasn't many, especially not in English. And so they found me, and people kind of asking me this question. I'd lived in the United Arab Emirates, and I kind of knew a little bit of the intersection between kind of the politics of the place, the economics of the place, and how the United Arab Emirates, and especially the royalty there, had used football as a kind of rebranding exercise for their country, a kind of vehicle of soft power. And so I really had this idea of the Billionaires Club, telling the story of how the new 1%, the super rich in the world, have begun to invest and found a home in soccer around the world for very many different reasons. And when you look at what's happening with soccer, you can see what's, you know, the kind of NBAification or the NFLification of the game. You know, it's the super rich that are kind of taking over from the traditional owners of football clubs, who are, you know, rich, millionaire, philanthropic people who kind of invested in their local football team as a almost as an act of charity. And now you see these, you know, the 1% moving into football to try to, for very different reasons, whether it's nation building, personal reputation laundering, profit, something that football hasn't been very good at generating. So I wanted to tell the story of these incredibly wealthy and powerful men who are changing the face of football, but also changing the face of the world. And I wanted to tell that story through football.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting dynamic and how much football has changed over the last few years and the influence of the new money, the new power people have brought in. The question I had for you with when you in that book, what was your access like to these owners and these clubs that you were talking about and trying to get the stories from?
Well, I mean, virtually none. And when I started off with researching the book in 2015, I knew that I would get none. And so the story I wanted to tell wasn't necessarily chasing them and getting their interviews, because they're a very secretive group of individuals who rarely give interviews. I mean, Sheikh Mansour has never given an interview in 10 years at Manchester City. He's only ever turned up for one football match. Roman Abramovich hasn't given an interview since 2006. They don't need to. They're too powerful. They're too connected. There's no benefit for them for doing an interview. So I knew that I wouldn't get... There are some people I did get to speak to. For instance, I spoke to Thaksin Shinawatra, the former owner of Manchester City and now deposed Prime Minister of Thailand. And of course, he's a very interesting character in this evolution of the globalised money in football. But I really wanted to tell the story of these men, rather than kind of where they are now, how they got their fortunes and who they kind of stepped on along the way. So it was basically through the losers. So for instance, you know, there's a big chapter on China. And so I tell the story of Chinese investment, how it started, how Xi Jinping, the premier of China, is a huge football fan and sees China as a world leader in the football business. And this is a kind of calling card for Chinese businessmen, because it's essentially a state, you know, controlled capitalist economy. Go out into the world and then invest in football, buy football clubs, you know, agencies and all these kind of things. And I told that story not necessarily through biographies of the owners, but through one example, which was when a small club in Holland, Ado Den Haag, is bought by an unknown Chinese businessman. And it was the experience of the fans of this club and the experience of the management and the coaches of this club with this kind of new era of Chinese money coming in and how it all went wrong. To me, that was that told the story of what's happening with Chinese investment. So I realised I'd get no access, and I tried to basically use that to my advantage in a way and tell the underdog story of the richest people in the world.
It's incredible. I love the notes of the book. This made me even more excited to read this book now over the coming weeks on my travels. And it should be an amazing story. Now, I want to move on to your other book. It's the 31-0, The Road with Football's Outsiders, World Cup Odyssey, which I think won an award at the British Sports Book Awards 2015 for the Football Book of the Year. So that was obviously when you and I met and covered our story of qualifying for the World Cup. And what would you say your favorite story was of this book and the stories that you covered?
I mean, there are so many stories in it in a way. And there was so much travel. And it's a time in my life I'll never forget because, you know, I go to 5 continents and I managed to get to some... I mean, there's some scrapes in there. But, you know, when I think of some of the great moments that I saw there, I mean, travelling with the Palestinian national team with their first home World Cup qualifier, but travelling first with them to Tajikistan because they were playing Afghanistan, you know, this one of the most obscure World Cup fixtures you could imagine, Palestine versus Afghanistan. And of course, it's just seeped with politics. And travelling... to Tajikistan and traveling with the team and getting that kind of level of access to teams, you know, as you know, you never have a journalist in a dressing room. You know, it's just not a culture of having, especially in English football, of having journalists outsiders in the locker room. And it because, you know, I was talking to teams at the very, very much at the lower end of the FIFA rankings, certainly at the beginning of the book, I got incredible access to people and their lives. And that, to me, the Palestine story was fantastic. But I think the one that really sticks out, which is what the book is named after, the 31-0 is the world record score that American Samoa lose to Australia in 2001. So I tracked down the American Samoa team, and they were playing a World Cup qualifier in Samoa, which is different to American Samoa. Samoa is a country. American Samoa is kind of part of the United States. And, you know, I went there and found this incredible story of the goalkeeper was still playing and his life had kind of been ruined, Nicky Salapu. His life had kind of been ruined by the fact that he'd conceded 31 goals. And for 10 years, it had lived with him, you know. And his kids had been mocked at school for it. It was, you know, all these players were carrying these incredible scars. And he had this gruff, like, Dutch coach, Thomas Rongen, trying to knock them into shape. You had a transgender defender playing for the team, you know, and she lived as a woman except when she played football. And, you know, all these stories came together, and I was there with maybe a dozen people in Samoa, like 3 o'clock in the afternoon, tropical place, the JS Blatter Stadium, and watching American Samoa win their first ever game. I think it might have even been their first ever goal that they scored as well. But being there for that, I think, you know, there's a brilliant film that was made. There's no journalist there except for me, and there was a film crew that made a great documentary called Next Goal Wins, which I don't know if you've seen it, but I would recommend that to absolutely everybody because, you know, it won a BAFTA in the UK, but they were there and they told this story, which is almost like a Hollywood story, but a documentary, and it really happened that way. So I think, you know, of all the places, there's so many. I mean, I obviously have a soft spot for Bosnia as well. You know, there was Iceland. I've followed Iceland for like Haiti. Going to Haiti is something that I'll never forget. But American Samoa, seeing them win their first game, I think was special.
I remember reading in that book, I think it was the time Bob Radley was in charge of Egypt. See, that I thought that was, again, a fitting story. An American going to manage in Egypt. He must have thought this is one heck of a different environment than I was ever used to. And I was trying to put myself in that position as to how you would cope with that, the pressures, what football means in a nation like that. And I think there was a lot of political unrest as well. How was it talking to him during that experience?
I mean, as you know, Bob has a reputation, or did have a reputation at least, in the US of being, you know, straight shooter, you know, call, as we say in England, call a spade a spade. You know, very kind of gruff at times, you know, that's the kind of reputation that he had. When I met him, he was an absolute gentleman. And what he was doing there, I'd been following the Egyptian story for a few years because I'd been reporting about football in Egypt even before the revolution and before Hosni Mubarak was removed after the Tahrir Square uprising. And a lot of my friends were ultras with especially with Zamalek and Al Ahly, which are the two big teams in Cairo. And these guys played a really important role in the revolution as well. I mean, that's a different story altogether. But you know, for Bob to kind of, he got the job, you know, during this kind of, you know, uprising, and then to stay there and to live in Cairo with his wife Lindsay, you know, and to not only live there but really attach himself and invest himself. And there was this, you know, there was this huge tragedy where like 72 people were killed in this very, of course, tragic stadium disaster. But there was all sorts of issues about it. It was kind of the Hillsborough of Egypt. And there was suspicion of collusion by the authorities in some of these deaths, you know. And the day afterwards, Bob and his wife went out and marched with the fans to show their support for the people that died there. And you've got to remember that this isn't a place where Americans are usually welcomed with open arms. And for him to, he was taken as an Egyptian, and walking around with him, everybody was shouting Captain Bob. And so, you know, it was wonderful how he had won hearts and minds. And it also helps that the team were winning every game. They won every game in the group stage. And the World Cup, you know, what was interesting was, of course, the World Cup was really important because they hadn't qualified since 1990. And they had this incredible generation of players, including Mohamed Aboutrika, who's probably one of the greatest midfielders I've ever seen in the flesh, probably the greatest African player to never play in Europe. But they'd won three Africa Cup of Nations in a row, and they'd never gone to the World Cup. And there was this golden generation of players that had never reached the World Cup. And they had a young Mohamed Salah, who was scoring the goals under Bob, you know, who'd given him, trusted this very young, you know, man to basically lead his attack up front, with Aboutrika like playing off him behind. And it, you know, to fail eventually with this, there was one game they lost 6-1 to Ghana in the playoff, and that ended everything. And it was all taking place as Egypt was collapsing, and there was a kind of counter revolution. And it was, I thought, the kind of the journey of the national team told a story about the journey of Egypt at that point, which was a kind of hopelessness, and then a hope. You know, there's this post-revolutionary rebirth, even in the face of tragedy, which then eventually is kind of snuffed out, and that's what you kind of see. And it was really interesting seeing, you know, this World Cup qualification campaign, because of course I've been following all the teams. I can't really get it out of my system now, and so, you know, seeing that Egypt did qualify this time, you know, they had the experience 4 years later. And also they didn't have the playoff system. Africa is the hardest qualification. They have 54 teams, and any one of 10 teams can qualify, and they only have 5 places. They have really tough away matches. So they changed it and made it a little bit easier this time. And so Egypt could make it. And so it was still an amazing experience, you know, it's an amazing achievement to qualify. But, you know, I was thinking of Bob, and I hear from him occasionally still, because we shared an experience over that time. And, you know, I wish him all the best in LAFC, and the new team in MLS, which he's building from scratch. And that's his forte. He works great with young kids. And, you know, I think he's going to come back and prove some people wrong after, you know, coming to the Premier League and it not really working out for him.
James Montague joining me here in the Season of Sports, talking about his football books and amazing football stories. James, I want to get into your When Friday Comes book, Football in the War Zone.
I can't believe you've read it. That's amazing.
Well, listen, I do my homework. I don't want to bring you on here on the Season of Sports and I'll be ready for you. I know that you actually won Best New Writer, the 2009 British Sports Book Awards, from this book. So congratulations on that award. But tell me about your your fondest memory from putting this book together?
This is, again, in a way, they're all kind of biographical or autobiographical, I should say, because I'm writing them at a time where I'm traveling around. I mean, it's the most personal book because I write a lot about my experiences in the Middle East as a kind of a foreigner and an outsider. And I actually moved to the Middle East in 2004, and I didn't really know the region at all. I didn't have any real clue where I was going. I moved to Dubai. There was my first journalism job. And immediately I kind of found football as a really good way to decompress in the United Arab Emirates. I found, you know, it's a way that you could meet people from other cultures. You could understand something about the place through football, because there was this love of football that I wasn't expecting there to be, and this deep football culture that I didn't expect to see. And so from there, I started traveling to different countries around the Middle East, watching football matches, and then just coming across these incredible stories. I mean, you know, I think probably, you know, one that really sticks with me is going to Yemen. You know, and Yemen now, of course, we see Ali Salah, the former president, was just being assassinated. There's a civil war, starvation. I mean, it was always a country that was on the brink of collapse. I mean, that's absolutely true. But when I went there, the thing that was more than tribalism and more than the kind of influx of guns, I think it's the second most highly armed country in the world. The thing that was really destroying the society was this drug called Cut, which I don't know if you've ever seen it for sale. Sometimes you see it for sale in English supermarkets, if it's a Somalian supermarket. It's kind of a leaf drug that grows at a certain altitude in Yemen and Kenya, and you chew it, and it's kind of like a mixture of, I suppose, kind of cocaine and ecstasy. And it really is powerful stuff. And it, like, it's just so many people in Yemen chew it. And I came across a newspaper article randomly, like a local newspaper article. I think it was the Gulf Times. And it had like a one sentence or like two sentences, like one column saying the Yemen Olympic team has been banned from playing at the Asian Olympic qualifiers because they'd all failed a drugs test. And it turned out that this the active ingredient in Cut is the drug, is on the IOC banned list. So I wanted to go and find out about this narco state, basically. So I went to Yemen and spoke to the head of the FA, who's this kind of Elliot Ness character trying to crack down on cat use and saying players can't play. And it's this big cultural problem. It's destroying the economy. It's destroying our society. And he sends me around, and we meet the players. We go to league games. Fascinating place. Absolutely beautiful city, Sana'a. And then after this long day of moral purity about how bad cat is, we go back to his apartment, his house, and his majlis, which is this kind of area where you're welcomed and guests are kind of entertained. And what do? He brings out the cat, and we all end up chewing cat for like 6 hours. So it was funny because it was, you know, even he couldn't really kick the habit. And I thought that was kind of quite telling. But that's something, because of course when you see the pictures now of the emaciated, starving children, and you know, you've gone there and you've seen it, and it's just heartbreaking. But I mean, that book is full of, like, the first time I went to Gaza, you know, it's not long after the last Israeli bombardment of Gaza in 2009 when I went there. But I mean, everywhere, going to Iraq in 2007, you know, like the height of the war, seeing the Iraq national team. Meeting the Iraq national team shortly before they won the Asia Cup, which was this amazing, probably one of the greatest underdog achievements ever in football. Right in the height of the war with a kind of multi-ethnic team, it was really football and sport at its best, I think. And so, yeah, I have a lot of memories from that, and a lot of, you know, powerful memories from that time.
Well, that's amazing. It gives you such a great insight on football in that part of the world, which many of us don't get, and you know, I really enjoy that story. Now, before I let you go, last question I have for you: you're going to head to Russia for the World Cup in 2018. What are your plans for that? What are your thoughts on the whole World Cup in Russia situation?
Well, I've been trying to go to Russia to do a story on the longest. There's a currently in the Russian Premier League, they have there's a fixture that's a 7-hour flight, because there's a team in the Far East. So I wanted to do like the longest away trip in the world. I mean, what's the longest away trip you've ever done? I mean, maybe East Coast, West Coast?
My longest away trip? I mean, Well, I've done 7 hours on the bus one day, James. That was from Yeovil to Carlisle. Now that's slumming it. But in actually a Premier League game, yeah, you don't travel more than a couple of hours really by bus, train, or plane. So the Russian league has its own challenges, that's for sure.
Well, I mean, this is a 7 hour flight, and when I was looking at, they're obviously just having the winter break now, but the last game at this team was, I think it was -12 temperature. So, you know, good job that the winter break was coming. I mean, at the moment, I've been doing some stuff for the Bleacher Report. I've just got back from North Korea, of all places, to do a story about football in North Korea. And so, you know, I got into North Korea, and the second day I was there, the H-bomb gets exploded. So that was a very strange time to be doing. And I went to watch an Asia Cup qualifier between North Korea and Lebanon, because of course they have a very good men's and women's team. In particular, the women's team is, I think they're world champions at under 17 and under 20 at the moment, so they're obviously doing something right. So I wanted to find out a bit about that. But the World Cup is coming up in Russia. I want to go, but I don't think I will go to. I went to Brazil after I wrote 31-0, and I found that the kind of the most boring sanitized part of it was going to the game. The stadiums were kind of, the games themselves were excellent, but the crowds weren't really representative of what was going on in Brazil. So I think what I'm going to do next time is I'm just going to travel around Russia and, you know, find the stories of ordinary fans, ordinary clubs, ordinary players, and, you know, yeah, just try and be where there aren't any other journalists, basically. But it's a difficult time to be holding the World Cup, of course, because, I mean, as we're talking, the IOC is about to make a decision on whether Russia should be banned from the Winter Olympics next year because of a collusion, state collusion in doping. There's a huge problem about morally, I think, about what Russia's doing in Ukraine, about intervention in other elections, in the US elections, for instance. You know, a lack of political and civil rights at home, not to mention even the alleged use of slave labour when it comes to North Korean labour's building this new stadium in St. Petersburg. So I think it is a very difficult time for them to be hosting it. And there's no doubt that Vladimir Putin, the president of the country, isn't a big football fan. That's well known. He is a big judoka. He loves judo. And so there's no doubt that he sees the World Cup, though, as being a very, it was essentially his, you know, policy to get it to Russia, because he knows the political power that hosting a World Cup has and what message that sends to the rest of the world. So I think it's a bit conflicting. Saying that, Russia has a deep football culture, and, you know, has produced some great teams, some great players. Even if you look at the Champions League now, you have teams kind of competing in the group stage and knockout stages. So given the size of the country, given the deep football culture, it makes sense to have it in a country like Russia. There's no reason why it shouldn't do. It's just, I think that, you know, especially with what's happened with Qatar, there's been more of a moral dimension about, you know, what's the human rights situation in the country. And this is something that FIFA will now apparently be looking at in future bids, which might be problematic with China, but who say they want to host the World Cup finals. But I think, yeah, it's, as everything with Russia, I think it's a bit of an enigma. And I have no doubts that they'll put on a great World Cup. I mean, I'm a little worried about the football ultras, because I mean, they look pretty tough. So I don't want to get on the wrong side of them. I mean, when you saw what they did to the England fans in France at the Euros. So yeah, I mean, either I start kickboxing, or, you know, I pick up my Polish a bit. Actually, no, Polish is probably worse. I'll have to pick up my Serbian better. I think that's the safe language, you know.
Well, listen, if anyone can deal with these people, you can. Well, James, you've been an absolute pleasure on the show. We'll save the West Ham talk for another time. I'll spare you that on this episode. We'll get into that. But thanks so much for coming on the show. You've been an absolute pleasure. For all you guys out there, make sure you go get James's books online on Amazon. When Friday comes, 31-0, The Billionaire's Club. You won't be disappointed, especially if you're a huge football fan who wants to know some of the best football stories out there. So, James, thank you so much for joining us. Really, really appreciate it. We hope to speak to you again very, very soon. And keep up the good work, my friend.
Thanks very much and good luck for the rest of the season.
So that brings us to the end of this episode. What an amazing chat we've had with James there. What do you think, Rachel? He was an amazing guest.
Yeah, I really want to be him because although I don't know if I want to be him in North Korea when the missile was launched. That's very scary. But everything else just sounds amazing.
It's a pretty fun job, huh? when you're in that kind of stuff. We really enjoyed it. So guys, make sure as always you listen to us on Audioboom, Spotify, iTunes. Please leave us a review. And let us know what you think of our show. We'll be back with you guys very soon. We're actually going to be live at the NBA London
Woo.
Game, which is going to be awesome.
Yeah, amazing. Very excited.
So we look forward to
that.
Boston Celtics, Philadelphia 76ers. So that'll be our next episode. And we look forward to having you guys with us all then.